We are the Environmental Affairs Board.
And you are listening to Green Radio on KCSB 91.9 FM Santa Barbara. Each week, we will discuss an environmental theme through interviews, current events, and discussion.
And we welcome your participation on the show by calling 893-2424.
Let's start off with a few recent environmental news headlines. Despite 20 years of effort, greenhouse gas emissions are going up instead of down, hitting record highs as climate negotiators gather to debate a new global warming accord. The new report by the International Energy Agency showing high emissions from fossil fuels is one of several pieces of bad news facing delegates from about 180 countries heading to Bonn, Germany for 2 weeks of talks beginning today. Despite the expansion of renewable energy around the world, energy-related carbon emissions last year topped 30 gigatons, 5% more than the previous record in 2008. With energy investments locked into coal and oil-fueled infrastructure, that situation will change little over the next decade. The June 6th through 17th discussions in Bonn are to prepare for the annual year-end decision-making UN conference, which this year is in Durban, South Africa. Scientists have discovered the first multicellular life in the deep subsurface biosphere. These nematoda are the deepest multicellular organisms found on Earth. This discovery is huge simply because scientists previously thought complex life was impossible at that depth. But perhaps more importantly, the findings give a different perspective on where life could exist in the universe, potentially miles beneath the surface of alien planets. The find entirely changes how and where scientists believe multicellular life can exist. While nematoda are known to live on the ocean floor and as far as 10 to 20 feet beneath the ocean bed, this discovery puts them about a mile beneath the surface. U.S. regulators have allowed a Canadian company to restart its Keystone Oil pipeline after completing repairs and safety tests. Oil from the 1,300-mile pipeline that extends from Canada to Oklahoma and Illinois could begin flowing as soon as Sunday under a revised order from the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. The pipeline has been closed since May 29th when workers reported a 10-barrel leak in Kansas. That followed a leak of 400 barrels of oil in North Dakota on May 7th. Areas where food supplies could be worst hit by climate change have been identified in a new report. Some areas in the tropics face famine because of failing food production, an international research group says. The climate change, agriculture, and food security predicts large parts of South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa will be worst affected. Its report points out that hundreds of millions of people in these regions are already experiencing a food crisis. Conservationists have embarked on a mission to save one of the world's rarest birds, the spoon-billed sandpiper, from extinction. Fewer than 200 pairs of spoon-billed sandpipers were thought to exist in 2009, and since then, the population has thought to have declined by a quarter each year. A specialist team of bird experts are flying to the sandpiper's home in northeast Russia to collect and incubate eggs and set up a captive breeding population. Experts fear that without intervention, the spoon-billed sandpiper could be extinct within 10 years. The count of 200 pairs in 2009 is said to be an upper estimate, and there may have been as few as 120 pairs at that time. Spoon-billed sandpipers are a small Arctic wading bird, sporting a bill shaped like a spoon. You're listening to Green Radio on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Chelsea Lorenz, and today we're going to be discussing transportation and oil. We're going to start the show today with an interview I conducted with Nissan Motor Corporation's Mark Perry, their Director of Product Planning, and he and I will be discussing the new Nissan Leaf, a fully electric vehicle that just came on the market.
I understand that the Nissan Leaf is the first mass-produced electric vehicle in the United States. Does Nissan have plans to bring more electric or perhaps hybrid vehicles to the market?
Yes, we do. I mean, the Nissan Leaf, as you said, is our first entree into the marketplace. the vehicle concept was all about going for mass market volume. So you could have done a two-door sports car. You could have done something small and niche. But we decided to go for a mid-size hatchback with high utility, 100 miles of range, you know, to again, go for volume, not just for niche. We've already announced three more vehicles coming on the Nissan side, and with our global partner Renault is bringing six. So you know, the alliance between the two companies, we're really staking a major claim and moving toward what we believe is the final solution, which is a zero emission solution.
You just brought up the fact that the range of the Nissan Leaf, it's around 100 miles. When do you believe that battery technology will allow an electric vehicle to have a range closer to that of a gas-powered car, which is around 300 miles?
What you're bringing up is really both it's a technical challenge on one side, but it's also a marketing and consumer awareness and education challenge on the other. I mean, the facts are, and again, the listeners out there, in the United States, and it holds true also in Europe, and China, everywhere we look around the globe, people don't drive that far every day. In the United States, 72% of the driving population drives less than 40 miles a day. You go out to 100 miles, and you're covering over 92% of the driving population goes less than 100 miles a day. Sure, there's an occasional trip where you might go farther, but day in and day out, we just don't go that far. You take those stats and even cut it even closer, you find that 27% of us driving here in the United States go less than 10 miles a day. So then you look at our household fleets, and we have most, and again, it's a little bit of a U.S. kind of situation where we have vehicles to meet certain needs. So your daily commuter car, car that you use every day back and forth to work, go to school, take your kids to dancing classes, soccer, groceries on the weekend, that can be your EV because you just don't go that far. Now, has EV technology grown to a point where this is a car you're going to take on your road trip from Santa Barbara to San Francisco? Not quite yet, but you know that's actually pretty close. Santa Barbara to St. Louis, that's a little bit further away. So with 100 miles of range, you satisfy your daily needs. And so it is it's a consumer perception and behavior issue, because what people don't realize is you wake up every morning with that 100 miles of range. Now, to answer your question about when is a 300-mile range solution, really what we're facing right now, you can do it today, but the car is going to cost $100,000. It's simply you're just adding cells, you're adding battery cells, you're adding weight, you're adding costs. You can do it, but it's not really that marketable. So what we need is a real technical breakthrough, and that can be 7 to 10 years in the future at minimum. It's nothing on the horizon.
How long does it take to charge the Leaf, and to what extent do you see the installation of charging stations being a successful fueling option? Because I know there are charging stations being put into many major cities.
Yeah, and again, it's part of this consumer education issue that we're dealing with. I mean, the best way to treat an EV is just like you do your cell phone. You plug it in every night, and you wake up with a full charge. And that's what the Nissan Leaf can do. You can plug it in anywhere, and you use it during the day, you plug it in at night, you wake up every morning with 100 miles of range, and you're fine. The Leaf can charge there's three levels of power, and it's really related to the speed of recharging that's available right now in the U.S. The plug that everybody's familiar, that 110-volt plug on the wall, you know, the Leaf comes with a cord set that you can plug in anywhere and get power out of that 110-volt plug. Now, it's slow, because there's only 1.4 kilowatts of power that come out of that plug every hour. The Leaf's battery pack is 24 kilowatts in size, so you can do the math. You're almost at 20 hours if you try to fill the car up from empty just on a 110-volt plug. We think most people are going to use 240 volts of power, which is your electric dryer circuit, your electric range at home. That's 8 hours or less. And then the Leaf is also capable of charging at a fast charge speed of 30 minutes, 0 to 80% state of charge. So, I mean, that's what the Leaf offers, is those three levels of charging speed, 30 minutes at the fastest, 8 hours at kind of midpoint, and then what we call kind of trickle charge at the slow end.
That actually brings up the concern that this fast charge may actually wear out the battery quicker. Does Nissan have an estimate for how long the battery will remain active, or even up to the 100 miles that it is right now?
The Leaf's battery was designed, and it's a patented design, unique in the industry, and it's really designed to accept quick charge. That's how we built the battery. That's what we had in mind as we thought ahead. So, to answer your question, first off, on warranty, the car has an 8-year, 100,000-mile warranty on the battery. Now, if somebody looks at the owner's manual, we suggest that you average one quick charge event a day. Now, what that means is, you know, over 8 years of use, if you average one quick charge a day, you know, no problems, no expected change in your battery. Doesn't mean that you couldn't quick charge. If you were doing that Santa Barbara to San Francisco trip and you need to do it twice on a weekend, that's fine, or even twice a day, or even three times a day, that's fine. The battery and the battery management system works to protect the battery pack, so you can never overcharge it or damage it. Now, if you did fast charging three times a day, every day, for the whole useful life of the battery, yes, you'd see probably 10% faster degradation of capacity after 10 years versus somebody who didn't. That's 10% over 10 years.
What do you consider to be the greatest successes of the Nissan Leaf as it starts being put out there?
Well, I mean, what we point to are the ones that really make the product concept. We brought an affordable zero-emission solution to market, and we're marketing it not only in the United States but globally. So it's a true mass-market, mass-produced electric vehicle. We've already built over 8,000 Nissan Leafs globally. That's more than all the electric vehicles done since 1998. So we've already exceeded the production in just the first couple of months of what's been done over the last almost 12 years. And that's just the start. So bringing an affordable, mass-produced electric vehicle to market is what we point to. Now, if you learn a little bit about the Leaf, there's some interesting stories about it. The materials inside are made out of recycled water bottles. So the fabrics that you're sitting on the seat, the floor mats, the carpet, the headliner, all made out of recycled materials. The car itself is 99% made out of either recovered or recyclable materials. So not only we don't have a tailpipe, you never use a drop of gas, there's never oil, no emissions, but it's also made out of recycled materials. And some people worry about, oh, what's going to happen? Are these batteries going to end up in landfills? 99% of the car is completely recoverable.
The automotive industry in the U.S. is currently around 13 million units a year. When do you see alternative fuel vehicles like the Leaf becoming a significant part of this volume?
Yeah, that's the huge question. I mean, most people are now, they've shifted their conversation in the last 5 years. You know, the question is always, the question before was an if. Now it's not an if, it's a when and how fast. So nobody is predicting now that there won't be alternative fuels, there will not be zero emission, there won't be fuel cells. It's a question of when and how fast rather than if. We believe, Nissan believes, 10% of the global production will be zero emission vehicles by 2020. Now, you put that in, and just, again, for your listeners, right now in the U.S., we believe that hybrids are a success, commercially viable, well-accepted, mass-market success. Hybrids are 2% of the marketplace. We're saying zero-emission vehicles by 2020 will be 10. So 2 versus 10. Lots of things are driving those forecasts. You know, primarily, it's consumer demand and interest. Gas prices, of course, will continue to accelerate it. Regulatory pressure will also help drive the change.
How many Nissan Leafs do you plan to sell in 2011 alone? I've heard that the Leaf was sold out via pre-sale. Do you have any plans to increase the number of units you will be producing? due to that demand?
Good news for folks in California. We recently reopened reservations for the Leaf. So our process has been that every vehicle is, and you use the term sold out, it's related to the vehicles are pre-sold before they're even built. So we don't build a Leaf before there's a customer standing behind that particular color, type, everything else. So they're basically pre-sold before they even land here in the United States. We had 20,000 reservations for the car September of last year, and we basically stopped at that point and said, okay, let's work our way through those reservations for vehicles, find out how many people are going to convert to orders, how many will actually convert to actual deliveries, and kind of work our way through that lineup of folks. We've done that. That's what all of our first deliveries are working out of that pool, and we just reopened that pool in California, the first seven states. We just did it a couple of weeks ago. So we have production capacity and availability, and, you know, we don't usually talk about, you know, sales numbers, but we're talking tens of thousands, not hundreds of.
Will Nissan's luxury division, Infiniti, have an electric vehicle anytime soon?
Yes, we have announced already that Infiniti will get, we haven't said when, because we don't usually talk about future products in a lot of detail, but we have said that Infiniti is going to get a premium sedan.
What other technologies is Nissan looking into that may help the environment through cleaner emissions?
And it's Nissan and also almost every other car company on the planet. I mean, we have the same technical cards available in our deck to play, and different people are placing bigger bets on different technologies. All of us have to improve our internal combustion gas-powered engines. I mean, simply the fuel economy improvements and the CO2 reduction regulatory improvements we need to make, all of us have to continue to improve our internal combustion engines. You know, the first step is to get to 36 miles per gallon. And then there's new regulations coming to take us out through 2017, which may raise that number. It's undetermined yet how much, but raise the number. We're all working on hybrids. Almost everybody now has followed Nissan into the marketplace and said that they're going to do some kind of pure electric vehicle. Now, whether it's a niche product, whether it's a test and demonstration fleet, you know, again, different people are making different technology bets. And then all of us also are continuing to work on fuel cells. Because fuel cells, which is really an electric vehicle that makes its own electricity on board, is really the long-term future. And all of these technologies are getting us toward, you know, both battery electric and fuel cell are the end game because they're locally produced energy, zero emissions on the environment. That's the end. Every other technology out there is a bridge to get us there.
Do you have a prospective time frame for when Nissan may be releasing a fuel cell vehicle?
Yeah, we have fuel cell prototypes in California right now. I mean, we're active. The vehicles are in Sacramento. They're not that far away from Santa Barbara, and they're running around the roads today. Pepsi has a few of our vehicles in a demonstration fleet right now. The issue with fuel cells is that kind of standard cost versus vehicle size versus performance variables that you're always working on from an engineering, purchasing, cost control basis. Answer your question, probably you'll start seeing some fuel cell passenger vehicles in the marketplace in some kind of numbers, you know, in the 2016, 2017 range where you'll start seeing some fleets. The issue for an individual consumer to own a fuel cell vehicle is if you think there is an issue with charging stations for EVs, there's a much bigger challenge with trying to put hydrogen in as a fueling station for a fuel cell vehicle. It's light years more complicated, more expensive, and more difficult.
Do you have anything else you'd like to discuss while we're on the phone today?
Again, I hope that your listeners, you know, go to our website, you know, NissanUSA.com. There's lots of information there about the Leaf and just electric vehicles in general. The fact that we talked about charging stations a little bit, in California, there are going to be over 5,000 publicly available charging stations for people to use up and down the entire width and breadth of the state. With those fast charge stations we talked about, San Francisco is going to be blanketed with them. The L.A. County, Orange County, down to San Diego, you'll be able to make those trips under an EV because of those charging stations. And they're all going in the ground as we speak. I mean, people look out today and they don't see too many charging stations, but that's going to change immensely in the next year. All of their permitting and the site inspections have done. There's a new press release almost every day where, whether it's Whole Foods or Best Buy or, you know, here in Tennessee where I'm based right currently, it's Cracker Barrel restaurants. They're doing charging stations. So you're going to see places to charge, and it will make the ownership of an EV or a plug-in vehicle of any kind easier to do. But again, the most important thing to remember is your fueling station of the future is your garage. You plug in, you wake up in the morning, you're good to go. Never change your oil, never put a drop of gas in, and there's not even a tailpipe on the Leaf because you don't emit any emissions.
Thank you so much for your time.
Happy to.
Next, we're going to hear the final part of the interview that I conducted with Quentin G., a UCSB graduate student in the philosophy department who is also taught in the environmental department and who is very interested in environmental policies. And this is the end of the interview. It was a three-part interview. And today, Quentin will be talking on the subject of oil, electric cars, and a little bit about renewables. If you're interested in hearing the first two parts of the interview, they will be or already are podcast online at the Environmental Affairs Board UC Santa Barbara website under resources. So check that out if you're interested. You know, we haven't yet talked about oil. We talked about coal, we talked about nuclear, we talked about renewable, but I mean, with the anniversary of the BP oil spill just over a year ago, do you want to discuss some of the implications of our current economy that's so dependent on oil as a primary energy source?
Yeah, I mean, oil is sort of a bigger problem. It's harder to switch off of oil. I would say it's, well, I don't know, I guess you could go either way, but we certainly need to find a way to get off oil. But what's good about oil is that it's a concentrated energy source. It burns a lot cleaner than coal does. So it's you really can't beat it. Some options out there for consideration. And so oil is basically used for transportation. It's used a little bit for electricity production, but that's really shrinking because it's so expensive now. So most people just use it for transportation. So when we look at the transportation issue, we want to ask ourselves, what are some ways that we can get people to transport from point A to point B without using oil? And there's two major ways to do that. The first way is an electric car system, and the second way is using biofuels. An electric car system is my personal preference, and I think most people that are concerned about renewables probably favor the idea of electric cars. It's a long road ahead. It's going to be hard to get off oil. It's going to take a lot of work, probably an intermediary sort of device that would serve in place of that while we ramp up the technology for electric cars would be hybrid cars and super efficient vehicles. Volkswagen has introduced a new concept car. They claim it's going to be out in 2013. We'll see. But that car gets 235 miles to the gallon. And actually, some estimates say it could be as high as 313 miles to the gallon. So, you know, we're dealing with people that are highly, highly creative, a sector that can be highly, highly creative, but they need the right incentives. Currently, the fuel efficiency standard for all automakers is 35 miles per gallon. Your entire fleet has to average 35 miles per gallon. If we were to bump that to 60 miles per gallon or higher, that would force the companies to start getting creative, to get innovative, to meet those goals. But because they don't have any incentive to do that right now, they have a little bit because they were recently increased to 35, they have a little bit of an incentive to increase their standards, but not much. If we were to give them a little bit more of a kick and say, listen, you guys really got to figure out a way to be more efficient, there would be some incentive there. In the meantime, we could have things like plug-in hybrids and all those things. But overall, the end goal is that we need to have a carbon neutral transportation system. And that can most easily be done, I would say, with either fuel cells or with electric cars. And fuel cells are essentially electric cars. It's just they use hydrogen as the fuel, whereas other electric cars use battery storage. Or, you know, there's been some talk in a few areas about capacitor storage, which is a similar idea. You're storing the electricity. Now, the other option, the other sort of potentially carbon-limited option, is biofuels. Biofuels are a very mixed bag. It's very complicated. The first thing to keep in mind is that the pollutants, the toxic air pollutants that come from gasoline, also are largely present in biofuels. Not to the same degree, but very present. Things like volatile organic compounds come up, VOCs. There's also, I think, some issues with nitrates. I don't know the exact concerns, but Mark Jacobson, the professor at Stanford, did some analysis of biofuels. And in fact, you still get a substantial negative pollution effect, so you'll get smog and all those things from biofuels. You also have a ridiculous amount of land use to get those biofuels. So keep in mind that photosynthesis, which is the natural process of the sun turning carbon and hydrogen, you know, all that stuff, into sugars that make the fuel, right? Photosynthesis is only about 1 to 2, maybe 3% effective. So best case scenario, 3%, maybe a little more, of the sunlight turns into the energy. We can have photovoltaic cells right now, solar cells, that have upwards of 18 to 20% efficiency. Furthermore, you also have the fact that fuels that we produce are actually burned in an engine, right? Whereas electricity is run through a battery or some sort of electrical storage. And engine efficiency can maybe top out at about 30% efficiency. So an engine can run, so basically you get 100 units of energy from the sun, maybe 3, 4% of that. So those 3 to 4 units of energy turn into fuel. Then you get into the fuel, maybe about 30% of that actually turns into motion in the engine. And then you have losses in all these other areas. So for every 100 units of energy we get from the sun, you maybe get about 1 unit of energy to move the car and the passenger forward. If you take a look at electricity by contrast, let's say 100 units come from the sun, they hit a solar panel. Let's say 20% of those that turns in. So you've got 20 units of energy. And the thing about electric cars is they're a lot more efficient. They're about 90% efficient because you don't have this huge combustion chamber burning and all that stuff. You just have electricity. So you end up with about 90% savings. So basically you could get about 18 units of energy moving the electric car for every 100 that come from the sun. Whereas with a biofuel car, it's only about 1. That's just very rough mathematics. But the basic idea is that the land use that would be required, Jacobson did this analysis, the land use that would be required would be basically anywhere between 5 and 30% of all of America's land to power all vehicles with biofuels. The 5% number comes from the industry, the 30% number comes from academic studies, so there's a bit of disagreement. But even if you take sort of the halfway point, you say maybe about 18% of the land will be required to get us all running on biofuels. That's a huge amount of land. I mean, 18% of all the land that we have, you know, excluding Alaska and Hawaii, that's a very large chunk of land just devoted to transporting cars, growing grass or corn or whatever so that we can turn it into fuel. You need less than 1% of the U.S. land to do the same function with electric cars and a photovoltaic system or solar-based energy system. So you can really see that there's a lot less land use required.
I think the largest concern with electric cars is battery use and the fact that batteries don't last forever. And how do you imagine taking these batteries, like this battery waste, and what would we be able to do with it, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the battery situation is a little bit of a tricky one. So battery technology is essentially getting better and better and better every single year. You can follow it. MIT publishes a great magazine that follows a lot of these things called Technology Review. And they discuss just some of the cutting-edge research that's being done. Basically, if you heard anything about batteries and that information is more than 3 years old, it's probably not very good information. But yes, batteries overall, there's a lot of toxic chemicals that are used in the manufacture of them. They don't last forever, even the better batteries do. They're getting better with recharge and things like that. But yeah, there's this concern. One of the key things to keep in mind, though, regarding batteries is that most batteries will last between 8 and 10 years. California actually requires cars, the manufacturer, to warranty the batteries for 10 years. And other states, I think most manufacturers outside of California, warranty them for 8 years. So that is a concern. Batteries are a concern, but they're not the biggest problem. The other thing to keep in mind regarding batteries is that they're about 95% recyclable. And it's not as if you can pull your batteries out of your car and just throw them away. Those have to be returned to the dealer. And so they make sure that they're put in place. Now, we do need to make sure that that's a well-regulated industry and that, you know, we don't have nasty e-waste recycling and all those types of problems that are a danger. But by and large, the recycling of batteries can be done fairly efficiently. And we should be looking and keeping our eyes open for other opportunities that arise. There are some other ways out there. Fuel cells are a little bit of a different option. And if we can get fuel cells to be efficient, we could generate the hydrogen with solar arrays, and then we could just plug that into a car and you just have water as a waste. So batteries are a concern. Solar fuel cells might be a good option out of that, but I think in general the battery concern isn't as big as most people would have it.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss while we're here today?
No, I mean, I guess just basically a renewable energy economy is possible. It's not a matter of how can this be done technically. There would be a lot of hurdles to cover, but it would not be insurmountable. And so many people in the energy sector, particularly the fossil fuel companies, their lobbyists, their think tanks or think tanks that they fund, things like the Chamber of Commerce, other well-greased, well-oiled, well-funded machines out there try to paint the picture that we really can't get off fossil fuels. And no one, I don't think anyone thinks that we could get off fossil fuels in the next year. But if we don't start moving in that direction and thinking about the policy options that are available to get us in that direction, we're not going to be able to get there. And so the idea is, yes, there are technical hurdles to be managed, but it's not an issue of technical hurdles that's really getting in the way here. It's the issue of political will. It's a matter of influence by the fossil fuel companies in government. It's a matter of them just sort of spewing out, you know, propaganda. I mean, you just follow it. I mean, you can see sometimes you'll have the CEO of Chevron or someone who works for Chevron or someone who works for Shell writing op-eds, or someone that works for a think tank funded by Chevron writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal or some other publication that says, you know, we really can't get off oil. I think it's possible. It's not going to be an easy thing to do, but it's something that's very feasible. And in the long run, it's going to be good for us. It's going to be good for our lungs. It's going to be good for the children and for the elderly that are at most suffering for it. But it's also going to be good for Americans overall. I should actually also note that that's what the American people want, too. If you look at public opinion polls, there was a recent one by CNN just this last February. 88% of Americans think that we need more solar energy. We need to rely on it more. 83% of Americans think that we need more wind. And when you start looking at the nuclear and coal picture and oil picture in particular, Americans in majorities are saying that we need to think about ways to get off of this. So it's also something that the American people want overall. Why aren't we seeing the policies? I mean, that, you know, that's a matter of Washington maybe not being responsive to what people want and more responsive to what special interests want. Republicans, Democrats, independents, they all want to see more solar. They all want to see more wind. It's a matter of what do the people that really pull the levers want. And currently, you can go to opensecrets.org and find out how much the oil and gas industry are spending in lobbying fees, how much they're donating to political campaigns. It's unfortunate to see them wield so much influence in the face of just dramatic public opinion that says we need to get on renewable energy.
Well, thank you very much for meeting with me today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Next up, we have an interview conducted by Edward Tabor, a UCSB undergraduate student, with Elizabeth Schopp, an associate advocate for the International Program of the Natural Resources Defense Council. They will be discussing the proposed implementation of a Keystone XL pipeline. As always, if you have any questions, please call in 805-893-2424.
Elizabeth, you're an advocate for the Natural Resource Defense Council. We're discussing the Keystone XL pipeline today. The project was proposed by TransCanada Corporation in February of 2005. And for those who are not familiar with the project, it's a pipeline that connects Alberta tar sand resources to refineries in Texas, spanning 2,000 miles across the continent. Recently, the EPA has declared the State Department's Environmental Impact Report, or EIR, inadequate and sent it back for additional revision. Advocates such as yourself from the Natural Resources Defense Council, National Wildlife Federation, Earthworks, and Sierra Club have released statements urging for alternatives to the pipeline. Thanks so much for joining us, Elizabeth, and look forward to our discussion. What is unique about the Keystone XL pipeline compared to other oil pipelines that go from Alberta to the United States that makes it such a hot topic?
There are really a few factors that distinguish Keystone XL from other pipelines. For one, the Keystone XL pipeline goes to the Gulf Coast rather than to the Midwest, where other tar sands pipelines go. So going to the Gulf Coast, that opens up the tar sands for having a huge export market from the Gulf, so that from the Gulf it could travel to Europe or China or really anywhere around the world. So there are arguments that we've heard that Keystone XL would bring energy security to the United States, but that's clearly false when the oil could just be exported anywhere around the world. The second issue is that this is the first tar sands pipeline that has been pretty much fully analyzed by the Obama administration. And it's really a game changer. When the Obama administration has made commitments to get us off oil as fast as possible, to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the country, turning towards a dirty fuel like tar sands is a clear step in the wrong direction.
You just mentioned a number of concerns, setting precedents for dirty oil, as well as an imbalance in the United States energy imports and exports. What's the Natural Resource Defense Council's primary concern about the Keystone? Is it a fear of a blowout, leaks into groundwater, ecosystem destruction, or, as you were just talking about, proliferating the infrastructure of dirty oil?
It's really everything you just mentioned. It's from the extraction to the actual pipeline transport to where it's refined. It creates a host of environmental issues throughout. So up in Canada, where the oil is extracted, there are currently 65 square miles of toxic waste lakes that the tar sands have created. So up in Canada, these toxic waste lakes are actually leaking into the Athabasca River and watershed. And it seems like it may not be just a coincidence that the communities downstream, the First Nations communities, are experiencing high rates of cancer. Then along the pipeline route, you may have actually heard that a couple weeks ago, the Keystone Pipeline, which is also a TransCanada pipeline that was just permitted in 2008 and recently built, had a 500-barrel spill in North Dakota. So these pipelines are really risky, and diluted bitumen, which is the substance that would be flowing through the pipeline, is actually more risky than conventional oil. It could corrode the pipeline and cause more leaks. And then in the refinery communities, the refineries that process tar sands cause a huge amount of pollution. So especially in communities like Port Arthur, Texas, which the EPA has already identified as an environmental justice community of concern, It's really unacceptable, the idea that we would be putting more tar sands into these communities to exacerbate the environmental and health problems that already exist there.
The EPA deemed the project, or the environmental impact report, inadequate in 2010. What will be changed in the second EIR as that review process gets underway?
Yeah, so actually, after a lot of pressure from members of Congress, landowners, environmental organizations, mayors, farmers, and other groups of people, the State Department published the second environmental review, which is called the Supplemental Draft Environmental Impact Statement for Keystone XL this past April. Unfortunately, they're only giving a 45-day public comment period on the pipeline and have said they're not going to hold any field hearings on the document, which is just as inadequate as the draft environmental impact statement. And so it does contain some more analysis of things like greenhouse gas emissions, but then while they do have a life cycle greenhouse gas analysis, they say that it's just, you know, so that we can have an understanding of the greenhouse gas emissions, but that they're not actually considering the upstream emissions in the review.
In the EIR, the no action alternative, the State Department said that the no action alternative, or for those, that would mean not building the pipeline. As a result of that, the United States would continue to acquire crude oil primarily from sources other than Canada to fulfill this demand and or find alternative methods of delivery of Canadian oil sands. These impacts seem to ignore the possibility that this gap could be filled by clean renewable energy, which would be more consistent with Obama's energy plan, which advocates secure homegrown energy. Does this supplemental EIR provide a more detailed assessment of these alternatives, taking into account these benefits?
No, the supplemental environmental impact statement provides only lip service to, you know, the possibility of reducing our demand. They don't analyze a true low-demand scenario in which we would significantly reduce our demand for oil and transition rapidly to renewable energies.
Just a quick side note. Is the U.S. State Department or is TransCanada compiling these EIS reports?
The State Department is in charge of doing the environmental impact statements. And there are several agencies, including the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, the Department of Transportation, and others, who, under the executive order that gives the State Department the permitting process, those other agencies are cooperating agencies, so that the State Department has to turn to them for their input as well.
60% of Canadian oil exports go to the United States. Where do Canadians' public sentiment and political sentiment lie in regard to this Keystone XL pipeline?
There's certainly varied opinions in Canada, but in general, the Canadian and Alberta politicians and the Conservative government have been very active in actually coming to the United States to lobby not only for tar sands, but they've actually been lobbying in the United States against our really important climate and energy policies, against California's low carbon fuel standard, actually, and have also been going to Europe to lobby against the European Fuels Directive because they're so concerned about any policies that might make it more difficult for tar sands to be consumed in those countries.
So based on those lobbying activities, I take it that Canada's environmental review process is less stringent than the United States' is?
That's correct. Canada likes to say that they're doing what they can to mitigate the impacts, but in fact, their policies are very weak and very weakly upheld.
You stated earlier that this is the first plan that Obama administration has scrutinized. Obama's energy plan calls for doubling renewable energy and cutting oil imports by a third. How does he reconcile this plan with his larger energy plan?
Well, I think that there's concern about importing oil from friendly countries, so that a lot of the time people argue that we should be importing oil from friendly countries rather than from hostile countries, so that Canada is friendly and therefore we should import oil from them. However, this is really a false dichotomy, because the problem is that when we're thinking about importing tar sands, what's actually happening is that the tar sands producers and the Canadian and Alberta governments are working on weakening our policies that would help us to get off oil. So, in fact, by still thinking about consuming tar sands, we're making it harder for ourselves to get off oil overall.
More specifically than just oil, tar sands, people refer to it as a dirty energy source, as its greenhouse gas emissions are a lot higher than traditional oil sources or kinds of oil. Are those greater emissions the result of the refining process, extraction, or transportation, or why are these tar sands so dirty?
Yeah, tar sands are mostly more greenhouse gas intensive because of the extraction and refining process. To extract tar sands, they can either be mined or drilled. But the mining equipment is massive. There are four-story trucks and shovels. It's basically, if you've ever seen mountaintop removal pictures or videos or in real life, they're basically doing that to the boreal forest in Canada. So they're scraping up the first couple hundred feet of the boreal forest, what they call overburden, and digging out this tar-like substance called bitumen, which is practically a solid, and then turning that into oil is also very greenhouse gas intensive and pollution intensive.
The boreal forest is a huge carbon sink for the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And is there any talk with international agreements of cap and trade and carbon sequestration that the boreal forest could be an asset to the nation of Canada?
Yeah, the boreal forest is certainly a huge asset to Canada in terms of its capacity to store carbon, but right now it's being completely scraped up by the tar sands industry.
Last question here. The Natural Resources Defense Council statement regarding the Keystone XL pipeline goes, quote, "At a time when we must embrace a clean energy future, tar sands take us far in the wrong direction. The United States should instead implement a comprehensive oil savings plan and reduce oil consumption by increasing fuel efficiency standards, hybrid cars, renewable energy, environmentally sustainable biofuels, and smart growth to meet our transportation needs." These alternative suggestions seem to fit nicely with Obama's energy plan. They sound great. Are any of these components of this comprehensive energy plan included in the alternative section of the ER? And if not, why aren't they, as it seems like that would be an easy alternative plan to this controversial project?
We completely agree that these are alternatives that should be analyzed in the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement for Keystone XL, but unfortunately they have not been. Instead, the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement says things like that California's low-carbon fuel standard, which would significantly cut emissions in California, they claim that it would actually raise global emissions with a very faulty analysis done by, some industry-sponsored groups. So basically, the State Department seems like they're, looking to approve this pipeline. They've done very faulty analysis. So what we really need is for everybody to weigh in with the State Department and tell them that this analysis needs to be done and that we do not need the Keystone XL pipeline.
What's the best way to weigh in with the State Department?
You can go to www.nrdc.org/nokxl and submit a comment to the State Department there. You can also talk to your senators or members of Congress and ask them to weigh in with the State Department.
Okay, thank you very much, Elizabeth. I guess additional discussion is available on your guys' website at www.nrdc.org/energy/dirty-fuels. I was cruising around there earlier, and there's a lot of blog activity that's exciting. And thank you for your time and your insight into this important issue.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so long. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us on Green Radio today with our discussion about transportation and oil. If you're interested in hearing our previous shows, they are being podcast online at the Environmental Affairs Board website, which is eab.as.ucsb.edu. They are located under the tab Resources. Next week will be our final show of the year, and we will be doing sort of a wrap-up. We'll have an interview with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Charles Kolstad. We'll have the rest of the interview conducted with Dr. Josh Schimmel, a soil microbiologist and the Environmental Studies Department faculty head. There will be a lot of other stuff too. So next week, 6 a.m., I'll see you then.